Welcome to Eyes on Investors. I've got a great guest with me today, Robert Hammond, who's had lots of experience investing in single-family properties. So welcome to Eyes on Investors, Robert. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Sure, it's my pleasure. So let's talk about what your experience is. And you've done a lot of partnerships, and you've been doing some of your own properties. You've got quite a few properties. How many properties do you have right now?
75
properties. So how many of those are your own versus properties you've done with partners?
About 10 on my own for my wife and I, and then the other 65 are partnerships.
Okay, excellent. So you've had quite a bit of experience. How many years have you been investing in real estate?
I started in January 2007 is my official start date as an investor. I got educated in 2006 in lifestyles. I did a couple of flips, but that I didn't really, and that's how I got my seed money. But I don't really include that as investing. Investing to me is buying a house and renovating it and holding it, you know, leasing it out. You know, the lifestyles model.
Right. So why do you consider that investing more than, say, flipping a house?
Because I accumulate equity, or I grab equity. I grab equity and I get the cash flow and I get the depreciation. That's really why. It's because I'm making money in different ways. Plus, I'm getting principal pay down. So there's a lot. I'm making money in about five different ways, I think lifestyle says.
And so, you don't get those advantages. If you're flipping a house, then you're not getting all of those benefits. You're making some money, but
not getting a lot of tax advantages. Uh-huh. You're taxed on a higher bracket. It's earned income instead of passive income.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with flipping. I mean, flipping those first two gave me the seed money to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I find really interesting about your experience, because you used the flipping to actually build up some capital so you could go out and invest in more properties. And once you had enough capital, then you, like the 75 properties you have now, those were, you know, purchase and hold and lease them out. So you've got the passive income coming from those, and you've built up your equity at the same time. So how much equity have you built up over the last, it sounds like you've been doing this for about 4 years now. So how much equity have you built up?
Well, that's a good question. If you're looking at today's prices, I haven't recalculated. I mean, at the time when we did it in 2008, 2009, we were looking at, I think, $2.5 million in equity capture. That included for everybody. And I think we were, actually, I did these numbers to my video.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think it was 1.5 was my wife and I's equity.
Okay.
Now, I have not taken the time to go back and say, okay, what's today's market value and how much, you know, the market value has gone down according, you know, so, you know, I'm guessing it's definitely less than 1.5 million or 2.5 million total.
Right.
But I don't have those exact numbers. I would guess it might be, if it all went down about 20%, I don't even know if that's about right.
These are all in Houston, right?
They're in Southwest.
Okay. Because I think the Houston market might have gone down maybe, you know, 10%. I don't know if it's gone down 20% per se.
Maybe 10% then.
Yeah. So maybe it's 1.1, 1.2 million now, something like that.
Yeah.
Which is not bad for 4 years of investing. And that's just the properties you and your wife own.
It was really 2 years of investing, and then the last 2 years was really just stabilizing. I haven't been extremely active the last 2 years.
Okay.
You know, those 2 years where I was just going gangbusters, you know, I was so busy that, you know, my wife wanted to have a baby, and she's like, okay, you have to stop buying houses so we can have a baby, and, you know, and she was right. It took me a while to kind of get off the freeway. I mean, it was like I was going freeway speed, you know?
Right.
And so, but I eventually, slowed down, and there was a lot to do in the stabilization mode, and we're still, I mean, we're in stabilization mode still, and but I'm, you know, I'm doing one or two here or there, you know, not much to speak of, but.
So the amount of time you're putting in now is a lot less than it was when you were purchasing all these properties.
Yes.
Over those 2 years. That brings up a good point I want to ask you about, because a lot of people want to get into real estate investing because it's relatively passive. So what activities in have you found are passive? You know, how do you benefit from it there? But some activities, it sounds like in your experience, are not necessarily passive, and they do take some work. So what's the differentiation between those two?
Well, acquisition mode, I feel like investing is, there's two modes. There's acquisition, and then there's property management or you know, long-term holding. The acquisition phase, it's almost like a startup. Just like any other business where there's a startup, it takes more time and energy on the startup side. Then once you have, once you've been through all the initial, you know, acquiring the property, rehabbing it, getting it refinanced, I mean, getting your tenants in there, and then getting, you know, long-term tenants in there. I mean, hopefully you can get good tenants the first time.
Right.
If it takes your second try, you know, then, you know, getting the property stabilized, good tenants in there, everyone's happy, and it's cash flowing, then it becomes easy. But, you know, then you've got to oversee the bookkeeping and put the systems in place to manage it with less effort. Like, we bought software for property management that actually it's a no-brainer. It's taken a lot off my wife's plate.
Uh-huh.
We outsource the bookkeeping. We learn how to, you know, for a reasonable cost. We find, you know, again, on the front end phase, there's building your team. There's a lot of startup, you know, all your different guys that you need to work with, all your, you know, the right CPA, all that, all the legal aspects. So.
Okay. So the expectation people should have is when they're in the acquisition mode and they're buying, they're making offers on properties, they're buying them, fixing them up, getting tenants, that does take time. It requires work.
It does take time. I mean, if you're going to G it yourself, you know, which I did,
yeah.
I GC the properties to try to keep the expenses, the acquisition expenses as low as possible.
So that took more time because you were working with all the subcontractors,
right.
Scheduling them. Okay.
And now, then I did all property management myself, too.
Okay. And at this point in time, with all these properties, you've outsourced some of the things like the bookkeeping and stuff. How much time do you spend doing real estate investing? I think you mentioned you're still doing acquisitions here and there. But how much time do you actually spend now managing these properties?
Maybe 15 to 30 minutes a day.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
So pretty minimal.
I just outsourced, and I need to outsource myself another aspect of what I used to do again.
Okay.
I just outsourced the marketing of the property, which means taking the phone calls from the prospective tenants, screening the tenants, showing the prospective tenants the property, that kind of thing. So that takes some time when you have a lot of properties. Now, if you're talking five properties, you know, it's a different conversation. But if you're looking at 80 properties, or because we also property manage, we have a little property management company that we do about another 10 properties on top of the 75.
Okay.
So overseeing 85 properties and then keeping them leased and all that kind of thing.
That becomes time consuming.
It can become time consuming.
But then there's enough properties and enough income, I would assume there's enough cash flow that you can outsource those and free up your own time, and it's still profitable for you.
Exactly. It is. And it's a load off, actually. That's part of the reason why I wanted to come on board on Lifestyles, is because it would force me to let go of the things I really didn't want to do. And if I'm just sitting at home, it's easy for me to hold on to things that I don't really need to be doing. Because what else am I going to be doing? You know, I mean, there, you know, you kind of can get bored if you're just sitting at home
You want something of purpose, yeah.
Yeah, something of purpose. So, you know, and I'm letting lifestyle mentoring, you know, being a mentor become more my purpose and my passion.
Yeah.
And outsourcing the other stuff. And in fact, I just had a conversation with a gentleman about outsourcing the other thing I do, which is overseeing the repairs. Because when tenants have an issue, they call me or they email me or something and say, hey, my AC's not working, or hey, this light switch went out, or what. And, you know, and then I couple them with the contractor, you know, call Hank or call Fred or call this guy. And, you know, so there's, I'm trying to formulate a way that I'm out of that equation as well.
I see.
Right. That's my 30 minutes a day, or 15 minutes or 30 minutes a day.
And both of those things sound like you'll be able to outsource yourself, and then that time's going to be freed up too.
Yeah.
So with all of the with all these properties, can I ask you how much cash flow are you getting, say, on a monthly basis from these? How much income are you making?
I wish I had the exact answer for you. Three of the partnerships, we're still pumping money back into the partnerships. We try to be as creative and not replace every AC, not replace. There's a lot of stuff that we kind of roll the dice on.
Okay.
And so like when the AC went out after the second year and it was $3,000 or whatever, that came out of our cash flow. So some of that, we've used our cash flow to actually pay for capital expenditures. So three of the partnerships, now we generally cash flow, we take home about $5,000 a month.
A month for the partnership, and then you split it up amongst the partners?
That's my wife and I.
Oh, you? So your part of that partnership is $5,000 a month.
Now, the theoretical cash flow is a different story. It's like, it's $22,000 if everything is leased and there's no
vacancy,
you know, perfect occupancy and no repairs whatsoever, then you're looking at $22,000 a month for all the partnerships. Okay. And then our share of that would be about $10,000.
I see. Okay.
And we're realizing about half of that right now. Mm-hmm. Lisa and I are realizing about half of what we can't be realizing. Mm-hmm. Because again, we're still pumping some of the cash flow into the two of the partnerships, and all the partners are okay with that. It's just the way we need to do it. What happened was the end of 2008, a lot of the financing dried up kind of overnight.
Right.
We still had about 30 properties in the pipeline that were in the hard money loans, and so instead of walking away from the table with $5,000 or $10,000, which is what we were doing, we were doing cash out. Instead of getting that money back to replenish our capital, all of a sudden now we had to come to the table with $10,000 or $15,000 to close them.
Right.
That ate up a lot of capital, and we had reserves built up for each partnership. Like, okay, we want a contingency fund, this much per property. So we had these reserves, and all of a sudden now we had to deplete all our reserves in order to fund the closings for these. And then so we've been slowly building our reserves back up. While we're building the reserves back up, we're taking hits, you know, with some of the vacancies. We've had some turbulent times, a little bit of vacancies, and then some ACs and other repairs. And the learning curve of how to become a really good landlord, that's a whole other ballgame.
Right. Oh, my phone is ringing. I'm sorry. I need to turn that off before I start these interviews. I apologize, everybody, for the ringing phone.
There was a big learning curve on being a really good landlord. Acquisition mode, that's why I said there's acquisition mode and then there's kind of landlord mode. Okay? Landlord mode is the science of really teaching people how to live in your house, and I don't have that science perfected yet. I'm still learning that science of teaching people how to live. You know, like, okay, you're going to live in this house, and you're going to treat it with respect. You're going to treat the house. You're going to pay on time. I mean, certain principles where you have to train people on that. We've done pretty good. But there was, like I said, there was a learning curve, and there's still a learning curve on all that, on that aspect of the business. So when you fail on that, and some of the failure economy related, where there are more people losing their jobs. I mean, people that checked out perfectly on the screening process, and you know, and unfortunately, one or two of them lost their jobs. One of the spouses lost their jobs. They couldn't pay anymore. They had to move out. So there's a cost on turnover. We had a lot of turnover last year, just a lot of turnover. Just people losing their jobs, and they'd had them 10 years, 5 years. But we absorbed all those costs, and one of my partnerships, we built up this, all that contingency fund that we wanted to, and we've been cash flowing out for a while, and of course people get much happier when they're getting checks and all that, so it's nice.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about financing then, because you've done a lot. Actually, what I want to focus on is partnerships. Have you done anything in the partnerships that you've learned from that you would do differently, or that you are doing differently because you've learned from those mistakes?
Nothing pops in my head.
Really? So you're pretty happy with the way the partnerships have operated and worked out?
I am.
Okay.
The only one that was, I would say, a failure was there was a small partnership I did with two gentlemen, and they weren't really educated on real estate investing.
Right.
So they took a lot of time on the front end. They wanted to be intimately involved. They wanted to be trained and everything. And then they didn't really live up to their agreement, which was where we're supposed to have joint accounts where I'm managing the process and I'm writing checks. All of a sudden, somehow they cut me out of the joint part of the account, and all of a sudden now I become begged for every check. And it got more and more like that, where they had a lot of control over everything, and it just became just a major pain.
I see. Okay.
It needs to be a little bit of a mutual trust there.
Yeah.
I like transparency. I have no problem with transparency, but you know, the trust thing has to work both ways.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's the thing, and we can kind of see it coming, because they were very hard to get to pull the first trigger, and they were, it was just so time consuming. You know, they wanted to walk the property 3 or 4 times and all this stuff.
Right.
It was more of a just the beginning, just getting into that partnership. Really, all the other partnerships, you know, there's been challenges, but communication was kind of the key to. Communication and transparency was kind of key to overcoming and dealing with all the challenges that go along with it.
Okay. So communication, transparency, how about structuring the partnership? How has that worked for you in terms of what do the different partners bring to the table? How do you set up your structure?
I set it up with an LLC. And generally we get an operations agreement first. And it's kind of, and this is the meat of the, and it's really not that complicated. It just says, you know, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what you're going to do, and this is what the split's going to be, and you know, you kind of implant that into the LLC documents, and of course, the LLC kind of covers all the what ifs. You know, what if so-and-so gets a divorce, and we need to dissolve the corporation, or he needs to be bought out. How does that work? Or if somebody goes bankrupt, what happens then? I mean, there's just a lot of what ifs. And you sleep a little better at night, you know, knowing, okay, if this happens, this is how it'll be handled according to the LLC documentation.
Do you find that going through that, the steps of creating the operating agreement, kind of forces the partners to put out on the table what all the expectations are, in a way that helps the partnership function better?
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that. It's pretty cut and dry. It's, generally, my partnerships were, you know, you bring the money and the credit, and you need to show up at the closings. You know, you need to be available for annual business meetings, occasional business meetings, you know, to some degree. We didn't expect too much of their time. And a lot of them were passive partners to that degree. And then here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do everything from A to Z on the acquisition and the property management.
Okay.
And straight the bookkeeping and all that.
So you partnered with people. You brought you had available time and you had experience. So that's what you brought to the table. They would bring the money to the table, and then that's how the partnership worked.
Time, experience, skill sets. I mean, there are some skill sets involved.
But how did you start when you first, you know, you did two flips originally, and then you started doing buying and holding. But how did you get partners to believe in you before you had a lot of experience?
Well, I had 10 houses under my belt.
Oh, you did before you partnered?
Yeah. Well, I bought did the two flips. I had 70,000.
Okay.
I did 10 houses over the next 4 months, 5 months, which was pretty nice, pretty interesting. You know, do 10 in 4 months.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of like, okay, I'm about out of money, you know, and I'm kind of Fannie Mae'd out, you know, the Fannie Mae.
They have a 10 cap limit.
And,
yeah.
And the debt to income ratio starts to, you know, it kind of goes each time, you know, and then it's like, well, you're kind of close there. You're right, you know, so you start to not qualify for the, you know, the loans and all that.
Right.
So, but I could at least articulate, okay, well, if I've 10 houses and I've made 28 on this one, 34 on this one, but, you know, then total, I made $300,000 equity capture.
Right. That's great.
Houses, that's average of 30. And then here's the cash flow. You know, projections and what it should be. Here's the PITI. Here's the gross rent. Here's what that is. You know, and this is the portfolio.
Yeah.
So basically, it was we can create a portfolio together.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I didn't realize that your 10 properties were done beforehand. I thought they were more recent, but that makes sense. So you did have experience. You had that portfolio. You could show that to your potential partners. Yeah. So how did you find people to partner with?
Well, Curtis was one of the key people for that.
Curtis Warden, I just interviewed him yesterday. So those of you watching this will be able to see that interview as well.
He was very instrumental. My first partner was actually a contractor who just loved what I was doing, and he was just kind of a go-getter, and he said, "Can we partner up?" And you know, so I said, sure. And we did two houses together. It was a small partnership, but, you know, he's a good friend now, you know, and good partner. And then Curtis was a pizza customer. I had a pizza shop at the time.
I think you mentioned that. It was like, he said it was just 300 yards away from his house that your pizza shop was, and he would go there and buy pizza.
He would come pick up pizzas, and he would always talk to me and try to pick my brain as an entrepreneur. I think he tried to get me to use his credit card machine processing company that he was a rep of. But we would just talk, and he's very talkative, and he's very, like I said, very entrepreneurial. And so he would come in, and he started watching me do this. I'm buying a house, and we'd have conversations about it. And so he kind of watched me become an investor. And we talked a lot on the phone, and I said, well, and he'd be like, well, can we partner up? Can we do something? I'm like, well, and this is after I had a conversation with Dell Wamsley. Dell was one that said, hey, you know, you've got 10 houses, you've got the track record, why don't you get some partners?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that kind of opened my I decided to open my brain to that, and
right. He
opened to that idea, and I reluctantly said, okay, I'll be open to that, and then that's when I'm like saying, Curtis, well, I tell you what, why don't you bring me some partners, you know, and you can be the third partner, and we'll figure out a way to make that work, and he was getting trained to be a broker, I mean an agent.
Right.
And so he became the agent, really,
mm-hmm.
For about 60 of these deals that we did.
So that worked well for him, being the agent. He got the commission. I think he told me yesterday he had a really small percentage in the partnership. But what's interesting here is that he went out, if I'm understanding this right, he went out and found the people with the money for you to partner with. So you didn't actually have to go do that yourself. You found somebody who that was just a natural thing for them to do.
Right. Curtis, he set up this meeting at this church. And five people showed up and said, hey, come meet this investor or some, I don't even remember what it was called. And so I stood in front of in this little classroom in front of about five people and said, well, this is what I've done. And, you know, and here's the addresses and, you know, and this is the numbers and, you know, and I'm here to just to be honest, I don't have anything figured out, but, you know, we're making some serious, you know, some serious money here, some serious equity capture, and this is a great market, you know, and so everybody was interested, you know, but one of them actually had money and credit and everything, and he was, so we had, he became my second partner, and, you know, and then so it was he, Curtis, and I formed the second partnership that we got, and that partnership did 22 houses.
Okay.
And then another, like a friend of Curtis's through church and kind of got word of mouth of this, and Curtis kind of hooked him up. So we created this partnership with Curtis's church friend, myself, and Curtis. So that was the second partnership. And then the other church friend was like another partnership, the one that I said didn't work out. That was, we only bought one house together, and then...
It didn't make sense to continue doing more.
I think Curtis withdrew, and I think I withdrew eventually too. And said, look, I say, well, I want you to just keep the house. You know, you manage it. You know, I wasn't really happy with the you know, with the situation.
Too much work.
Well, and yeah, I was. Yeah. So, so those are really the partnerships that Curtis and I. Now, the second partnership was like eight properties. So,
Okay. So
two of the partnerships with Curtis, I think we have about 30 properties.
Between the two partnerships?
Yeah, between the two partnerships. And then the other ones were like, I think a PIG member at Lifestyles approached me through word of mouth. And, you know, he said, hey, I really want to do, you know, I've got this much money I'd like to buy some houses and, you know, let's partner up. So we bought 13 together. There was, and then a friend of mine who actually, maybe 20 years ago, we had talked about doing this together. He came over at a party and he saw my whiteboard. On my whiteboard, all the houses and the numbers and all this, his wife said, you need to get into this, you know, now. You know, and he's like, okay. So he approached me about it, and so we did about six houses together.
Uh-huh.
We had that partnership, and then my dad became a partner too. He was like the last partner.
Okay.
Until the one that we just did.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So I want to get your opinion on something. When I first started doing these interviews, which has been about 2 months ago, I thought, I really need to dig into the technicalities of how to acquire properties and how to lease them and screen your tenants and all that sort of thing. In our conversation today, we've talked very little about that. We've talked more about how you've built your business, how you've networked with people. And what I'm wondering is, if you were to weigh the value of learning how to network with people and build a business versus the technicalities of actually doing real estate investing, which one do you think is more important or more valuable to people that are interested in doing real estate investing?
Depends what part of the real estate. They're just going to build a small portfolio for themselves. You know, the technical is good. I think the former, you know, the sales skills and networking skills, the ability to learn quickly and put your ego aside, I think those are all invaluable.
Okay. I had a feeling you would say that. That's what I'm coming to find out as I talk to more and more investors, is that it wasn't the technical knowledge that enabled them to be successful, but it was their ability to talk to people, to network with people, and to learn. They had to have a desire to learn. So where you, I'm looking at your experience and seeing, well, you know, back in 2006, you decided you were going to do this. So you went and flipped two houses, got some capital. Then you went and did 10 more houses until you couldn't do any more because you kind of reached the limit on your financing side. And then you built with like crazy your business with these other partners to where you've got, you know, over $1 million in equity. You've got, you know, $5,000 at least a month of this income coming in. So it's, you learned how to do the stuff you needed to do very quickly, but that wasn't really the key to your success. The key to your success was getting out there and doing something and talking to people and making things happen.
Yeah. Pulling the trigger, overcoming your fear. That's the initial hurdles, getting over the fun. Yeah. And building that team, like I think you were saying that. I mean, talking to people, that's all about team building. And you really have to keep holding those, you have to keep those skills because, you know, the real estate game changes all the time. The market changes. A lot of variables change. So you have to learn, you know, what worked last year might not work right now. You know, you have to kind of continue to be open, to improve your systems. And, you know, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm still improving my systems. You know, there can be a lot of money made just by doing that.
Yeah.
And not necessarily acquiring more.
Right. Let me unplug my phone. Hold on a second. Okay. I've learned my lesson. Next time I do an interview, I will unplug the phone before I do the interview. Now, you mentioned something a minute ago that I wanted to follow up on, too. It's tied into what you were just saying. When you had that little meeting with the five people at the church and you kind of laid out, look, here's what I've done. I don't have all the answers. I don't know everything right now. That kind of struck me, that comment there. Why did you tell them that you didn't have all the answers and that you didn't know everything?
I don't know. I just I didn't want to come across like an expert. I don't know. It's just kind of natural. I guess I try to be as honest as I can as a person. And I don't recall what the motivating factor to say that was, but I noticed that the more honest I am, sometimes I shock myself because I'll say exactly what I'm afraid to say. It's almost become a compulsion, and I did that in all my partnerships. Like, okay, what are they? It's not like I'm saying what do they not want to hear, but that would be a lot of the times the first thing I would say is what they don't want to hear.
I see.
You get off the table. I just like to live my life that way. You know, not kind of hiding in fear, but just put it on the table. A lot of times, it's not nearly as bad as you think it's going to be once you kind of put it out there.
Right. Well, and I wonder if people see you as a more real, down to earth, credible person too. When you acknowledge something like that, it probably helped build that credibility.
Yeah, that's my real desire. Is I'm trying to create this facade I guess it does. It does, and it takes the pressure off.
Right.
You know, set myself up as a guru that's one knows everything. Then they're going to expect me to be perfect and to perform unbelievably well. You know, and I do perform very well, but I do the best that I can, and I can't control everything. And I do make mistakes, you know, but I learn from them. And so as long as we're all, like, that's the kind of atmosphere I want. I don't want somebody micromanaging me, expecting me to be perfect. That's why I got out of corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want new bosses, you know, partners. And, you know, and it's, partners can be, they're kind of like bosses. I have to, you know, I became accountable again to somebody.
Right.
I'm accountable to my partners.
That's true. And if you have super high expectations that aren't even realistic, like if you go in there with the you know, making it look like, hey, I know how to do this stuff perfectly. I'm not going to make any mistakes, and we're going to make a ton of money, and you can't meet those expectations. That would be very stressful, I would imagine, to have that.
And we did have some of that. We did have, in fact, we had some conflict in the beginning, and a lot of it was, it kept coming back to, Robert, you really need to do a better job of managing expectations. Because a lot of what I did, you know, I was good at saying, hey, I don't know everything, but I also was very optimistic. I said, hey, you know, we're going to make $30,000 a house, equity capture, we're going to make $250 cash flow, you know, and then when, you know, when we had turnover and things happen, AC go out and we didn't have cash flow, you know, hey, why aren't we cash flowing, you know? People get ticked off, you know, and say, why aren't we cash flowing? You know, I mean, I put this money in here, I expect cash flow every month. And so, you know, there was conflict. Yeah. But I think they're all good now. Yeah. But there's times where it was rocky. And I think the communication and, you know, that helped kind of get through that. Mm-hmm. But and it was almost like I'm bad because I'm so optimistic. You know what I mean?
Right.
I'm the bad guy because I'm so optimistic, but it's my nature to be like rosy thinking, you know, very optimistic.
Yeah. It wasn't that you were promising those results. You were thinking in your mind, I'm going to do my, you know, I'm going to try to accomplish this. These are the things that can be done. I'm optimistic about how this is going to go.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what happened is that optimism became the thing that set the expectation. But since then you've learned you can continue to be optimistic, but you also set expectations more realistically.
Yeah, and I've been through more now.
Yeah.
You know, when I had 10 houses, I was still on the front end of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was still on probably all my original tenants were in there, you know, and I hadn't been through turnover yet, and, you know, and I hadn't been through my first winter where, you know, 4 of your 10 units were rusted out and you had to replace, you know, the furnace. Or, you know, I mean, that's expensive. And so there was a lot I didn't know. I was still kind of fresh. You know, now I'm 4 years into it. I've been through the ringer a few times. I know a lot, you know, there's a lot of things I wouldn't say, you know, like I wouldn't expect the ideal cash flow to be the cash flow.
Right.
So now I would say, well, that's our ideal cash flow, but there's going to be turnover. There's going to be expenses,
some repairs, yeah.
Repairs, you know, and that's what we're going to split.
Yeah, excellent. Well, this has been a great conversation, Robert. I've learned a lot actually, and have really enjoyed it. And I appreciate all the things that you've shared. Are there any other thoughts you have that you'd like to share with anybody that's listening? Any important thing that we missed?
No, I can't think. I think
it was fine. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you again for your time, Robert. It was great.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.